Unseen Diversity, Lecture 7. An Enormous and Diverse Group. The Proteobacteria.
This lecture is about an enormous and diverse group of bacteria called the proteobacteria. And the proteobacteria are a wonderful example of the kind of upheaval and excitement that occurred when DNA sequences began to be routinely produced and analyzed. This particular large group of bacteria, the proteobacteria, had been known through the entire 20th century, pretty well established, we thought, in respect to their classification. And then came a wonderful, exciting upheaval of all of that with DNA sequencing. So the proteobacteria. If you go to NCBI, the National Center for Biotechnology Information, which is the repository for all the DNA sequences that are coming in, a huge, well-organized database where you can get any DNA sequence you want. And if you look at all of the bacterial genomes there, you will find that about the 600 that are there currently, about half of them are of proteobacteria, so about 300. Are of proteobacteria. That's at this speaking. That's a constantly updated database, and those numbers will change in the future, but about half right now are proteobacteria. So what does that mean? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that half of all the bacteria in the world are proteobacteria. It does mean that proteobacteria have been relatively easy to culture, so that through most of the 20th century, during which a lot of microbiology was happening in the lab with culturing and staining and that sort of thing, proteobacteria featured very highly as the subject. And so when it came time to sequencing, obviously everything that we could get in the laboratory was sequenced first, or much of it was sequenced first. And therefore, the database reflects that, the number of genomes that are completed, the number of bacteria that we understand the DNA of. The other thing that skews the database of genome sequences to the proteobacteria is that of the pathogens that we know well and that are well studied, many of those are proteobacteria. That does not mean that all proteobacteria are pathogens, far from it, but pathogens often are proteobacteria. So the small number of bacteria that are pathogens often are proteobacteria. And I will, of course, be saying more about that in the lecture that I'm going to devote to pathogens, and I'll tell you exactly who some of those proteobacteria are. So what will happen in the future as more and more sequences come in? I think the proteobacteria will eventually get to their correct place as one among many of important groups of bacteria and archaea, and I don't think they will dominate the database as much as they are dominating it now. But if you want to get hold of some proteobacterial DNA sequences, at this point, they're pretty easy to get a hold of. Now, here's a really interesting thing that happened. The proteobacteria had gotten all sorted out into different subgroups, all based on their behavior on petri dishes and their behavior with stains and their behavior with various nutrients that were added to petri dishes and other criteria of that sort. And microbiology students for generations memorize those criteria. And I can remember in graduate school myself, when I was first starting to get interested in bacteria, taking the proteobacteria very seriously and learning a great deal of the classification by heart so that I could use it, which is a typical thing for scientists if they're going into a particular field to really try to understand something. Then came the DNA sequences, and everything was completely disrupted, so that groups that we thought were good natural groups, you know, worth classifying together, suddenly were in completely separate places in the proteobacterial section of the tree. Proteobacteria occupy their own major branch of about 15 major branches on the family tree of bacteria and archaea. And suddenly the proteobacterial section of the family tree was completely unlike what we would ever have suspected. I think the major problem was that, of necessity, the proteobacteria had been categorized by their metabolism. and their metabolism is the taking up of nutrients, the processing of nutrients, the output of wastes, all of the things associated with that. And some of those metabolisms were pretty exotic. So there was a thought that, well, this is the criterion upon which we are going to group a certain number of these together around doing this particular metabolism. The big surprise was, well, didn't seem to matter what sort of metabolism they were doing. The groups fell out in a completely different way. Possibly some of that was due to the prevalence of horizontal transfer, which I mentioned a few lectures back. Horizontal transfer, that tendency for bacteria and archaea to exchange their DNA promiscuously across whatever the species boundaries are, if there are even real species boundaries among them, so that instead of getting a nice, clean family tree, you get this anastomosing family tree. So that could be part of it, and it could be that metabolism is just not the big divider and classifier that we thought it was. So guess what? Here are the new classifications of the proteobacteria: alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and epsilon. And I think that is one of the best indicators of just what an upheaval that was. So much so that once those classifications had settled down, and they are pretty settled at this moment, so we actually refer to alpha proteobacteria, delta proteobacteria, those are in common parlance right now. But even then, no microbiologist has stepped forward to do what most scientists, most biologists would do, and that is to invent a brand new multisyllabic name based on Latin or Greek. There's nothing we like better than inventing a brand new multisyllabic piece of terminology that everyone is going to have to memorize and use. But everyone has backed off from doing that, and everyone's staying very calm, and alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and epsilon are sticking in the literature to the point where we even use them as nicknames. So if you hear a microbiologist saying, oh, those are the alphas, or that's the beta proteos, or those are some epsilons, that's what they're talking about. And it's all coming out of the new DNA sequencing upheaval of the family tree, particularly in that section. Now, I'm going to focus here on some of the more charismatic proteobacteria, with interesting stories and recognizable field marks. Because remember, one of the goals for this course, one of my aspirations for this course, is that this becomes a more integrated part of your nature studies. And it's one of my aspirations for myself, that when I go for a walk in the woods, I'm seeing not only all of the animals and plants that I can see and all of the fungi, but I'm also aware of the bacteria as much as I can be. So I've chosen some particular examples that may be helpful to that endeavor. And there will be more examples coming in subsequent lectures in this course as well. So the first example I've chosen is of an alpha proteobacterium, or alpha proteobacterial group. And this is a group that can fix nitrogen. And I will give you one name from this group, but it is by no means the only name. Alpha proteobacteria is a large group, and this is just going to be one genus name that happens to fix nitrogen. But it's somewhat memorable. It's rhizobium. And you can hear the word root there. Rhizo means root. So rhizobium, root bacteria. Now, lots of bacteria can fix nitrogen, and it turns out to be an extremely important thing to do. These particular alpha proteo nitrogen fixers do so in a way that is visible to your eyes if you know how to look for them. Here's what nitrogen fixation is, and here's why it's so important. We have about 79% nitrogen gas in our atmosphere. And for the most part, for most metabolisms, it's as good as being inert. It's not an inert gas, but in the sense that many of them are. But it might as well be an inert gas, in that we breathe it in and we essentially breathe it out untouched. So here's the vast majority of the gas in our atmosphere is not anything that we can directly use, and not anything that most organisms on Earth can directly use. The only exception is from the bacteria. The bacteria can do something remarkable with it. Here's the thing, though. That's nitrogen, and that's the major way to get nitrogen on Earth is through the nitrogen that's stockpiled in our atmosphere. And yet we can't get a hold of it. We need to do something with it. Something needs to be done with it in order to get it into a form that we can use, because we're made of nitrogen compounds. Our DNA is full of nitrogen. Our RNA is full of nitrogen. Our proteins are full of nitrogen. Various other parts of our bodies are full of nitrogen. So it's an essential nutrient for us. How do we get it? Nitrogen-fixing bacteria, taking a lot of energy, and in environments that have little or no oxygen, are able to convert that nitrogen to ammonia. And that's the same ammonia that you might be thinking of as what's in a bottle under your sink being used as a cleaning product. So that's what I mean by ammonia. You can smell ammonia, and that's a sign of that particular chemical, an unmistakable sign that you're smelling ammonia. And ammonia is essentially fertilizer-like. Ammonia quickly can be used by a host of other organisms, including other bacteria. It's just a couple of steps away from being easily used by plants and incorporated into their tissues. And then plants are just a few steps away from being eaten by herbivores of one sort or another. And thus the nitrogen goes through organism after organism after that. So the really difficult step is to go from gaseous nitrogen to ammonia. That's the nitrogen fixation step that starts the whole thing going. And only nitrogen fixers can do it. So how can you get a look at them? Well, especially in a temperate environment. I'll say something briefly about a tropical environment right after this. But especially in a temperate environment, if you pull up a plant that is of a type called a legume. And legume is sort of a catch-all term for more than one family of plant, but you can still look up legumes in plant books and come across a whole list of them. Could be a pea or a bean plant in a garden, or it could be clover, which is a real likely one to find in some temperate environments, whether it's in the lawn or along the roadside. If you pull up something like that, and I would recommend not just yanking it out of the ground, but rather using a trowel or a shovel to take up a divot of earth with it, because what you want to look at is kind of delicate and you don't want to just rip the plant out of the ground. And if you then gently rinse the roots of that legume in a bucket of water and then look closely, you will see that the roots have little nodules all over them, little tiny bumps that are not the usual thing that you see on a root, not root hairs, not the usual fine structured thread that you see that usually makes up roots, but little tiny nodules. And those are specialized plant parts manufactured by the plant for the purpose of maintaining a little culture of nitrogen-fixing bacteria. Essentially, the plant is maintaining a little fertilizer factory, because nitrogen fixation is essentially the first step to making fertilizer, and it confers a huge advantage on legumes. It's why lots of legumes can be the first colonizers of land that is of marginal use, that has relatively little nutrients in it. It's why sometimes a vacant lot will have lots of clover in it and lots of vetches and lots of other leguminous-type plants. And again, if you go to that vacant lot and start digging up some of these plants and rinsing the roots gently, you will definitely see these tiny nodules. Now, I said that in order to fix nitrogen, there needs to be a lot of energy put into that process. And so indeed, rhizobium devotes quite a bit of energy to doing it. It's important. I mean, it's the way rhizobium itself is going to get its nitrogen that it needs in order to make parts of itself. The additional factor is that the process of fixing nitrogen is best done with little or no oxygen present. Oxygen interferes with the reaction. So nitrogen fixers have a number of different strategies for that. One of them is simply to stay away from oxygen. Doesn't take too much of a removal from the surface of the earth to get to a point where there's no oxygen. You go deeper in the pond, you go deeper into the soil. So there are ways of getting away from oxygen that way. You can also, and this is the strategy for some alpha proteobacteria, step up your metabolism to the point where you're using oxygen at such a high rate that there's essentially not a whole lot left around to interfere with your other reactions, which is kind of an interesting take on how to avoid oxygen. And then there is what's going on with these leguminous plants. If you take one of those little nodules that is on the root and break it open with your thumbnail or maybe the edge of a Swiss Army knife, you will see just a little hint of pink inside. And that pink is a type of hemoglobin. It's the same kind of hemoglobin as we have circulating in our bloodstream, except it's being used for rather a different reason here. That hemoglobin is binding oxygen, just as ours does, but it is binding it in a way that keeps it away from the nitrogen fixation reaction. And it's being manufactured by the plant and the bacteria together to maintain that reaction in those nodules. It's a different use of hemoglobin, what we usually think of, but I will also say that throughout the natural world, there are lots and lots of examples, perhaps more examples, of hemoglobin being used in this way than hemoglobin being used the way we use it and the way we think is typical, which is to deliver oxygen someplace where it's going to be used. It's, I think, more typically used to keep reactive molecules like oxygen away from other reactions where they might be destructive, as is the case here. So that's your first example of a easy-to-see alpha proteobacterium. And I said that I would mention something about nitrogen fixation in the tropics. Later, when I do the lecture on cyanobacteria, I will say something more about this. In the tropics, it appears that most of the nitrogen fixation is not happening from alpha proteobacteria, but is happening from cyanobacteria who can also do it. So I will evoke them again in a later lecture and connect them up with nitrogen fixation. So this is looking for nodules is more of a temperate zone activity. And again, you should probably have a plant guide with you so that you can first locate some legumes to make sure you're pulling up the right plants to have a look at them. Second group of proteobacteria that have an interesting story with them and that with a bit of luck might be accessible are the magnetotactic alpha proteobacteria. And you can tell from their name a little bit about what they do. Magneto, magnet, tactic. So what they're doing is they're traveling toward one or the other pole of a magnet. Okay, they're sensitive to magnetic fields. They're little rod-shaped alpha proteobacteria, and they've got a little row of magnets inside of them that are oriented so that all of the north poles are facing in one direction, all the south poles are facing in the other direction. If you look at these under electron microscope, which is not a typical microscope for people to have access to, so you're more likely to see a picture of them taken under an electron microscope, you see this little delicate row of magnets inside of them. And they are sensitive to the Earth's magnetic field. And one of the very first questions that came about when these bacteria were first discovered was, why on Earth would anything as tiny as an alpha proteobacterium need to be sensitive to the Earth's magnetic field? You could imagine why a migrating bird or a migrating turtle or whales or some sort of enormous migrating organism that's ocean going and is having to go from one section of the Earth to another might be orienting along the Earth's magnetic field. But why on Earth would something as tiny as a bacterium be doing that? The answer turns out to be something like this. If you look at or imagine the globe of the Earth with the North and the South Pole looking somewhat magnet-like, and if you imagine the lines of magnetic activity that get typically drawn around the globe that curve in toward the North Pole and curve in toward the South Pole but are going more or less parallel at the equator, then you might also be able to see that the magnetic forces are not just pointing north and south. They are also pointing up and down. That is, they curve toward the north, they curve toward the south, and that curve is inward And therefore, they can also be used, these magnetic forces, to orient up and down in some sediment or some water or some mud. That's what these bacteria seem to be doing. These bacteria prefer to have a particular position in mud or thick sediment or water that is just exactly in the right position. And by sensing the magnetic field, they can actually orient themselves and know essentially what's up and what's down. And you know, if you've ever been swimming in a situation where the waves have thrown you topsy-turvy and you're all disoriented, sometimes there's a brief moment of not knowing what's up and what's down. Well, same for bacteria that are in sediment or water. How do they know what's up and what's down? In many cases, it doesn't matter too much, or they have some other mechanism. But in this case, the magnetotactics are using magnets. Now, how can you get a look at these? Well, you could try this. You could go to an estuary or a freshwater pond, and you could dig up some nice black sediment, and you could put it into a jar of water, maybe fill it half full of sediment and the rest of the way with water. You could cover the entire jar with foil. And then here comes the fun part. You could take 5 or 6 magnets and you can tape them to the side of the jar. And wait a few weeks, and if you're lucky, if there were magnetotactics anywhere in the sediment or anywhere in the water, when you remove the magnets and take the foil off, you should see a tiny grayish, whitish spot where a little clump of bacteria have congregated where the magnet was. Now, there's an interesting thing going on with hemispheres. Northern hemisphere bacteria, where they were first discovered, northern hemisphere magnetotactic alpha proteobacteria, where they were first discovered, are north-seeking. They seek the north. And so you want to orient your magnet such that they can seek the north pole of your magnet. As soon as the researchers who discovered this discovered that they were north-seeking, they immediately wanted to answer the question that is probably coming to your mind: what are the southern hemisphere magnetotactics doing? So these scientists were very lucky. They immediately got a trip to Australia out of this, paid for, of course. Not to mention a trip to the equator, because we need to find out what they're doing there too, right? So the southern hemisphere magnetotactics are south-seeking. The ones at the equator do a little of both, because there's another idiosyncrasy here that I didn't mention yet, and that is if you really take a close look at the magnetic field around the Earth, it's not perfect and linear the way it sometimes gets drawn in textbooks. There are lots of little idiosyncrasies and anomalies. In other words, there's not a perfect line of force going from north to south. And so along the equator, there are all sorts of idiosyncrasies. And so at any given point, depending on what the Earth's field is like, there will be bacteria that are corresponding to it. So you can find both north and south seekers, according to the scientists who made the trip to the equator to check this out. So that's a proteobacterial group with a nice story to it, a fun story to tell, and also the possibility of maybe getting a glimpse of them if you can isolate them. If you do isolate them, you can actually put them under the microscope and essentially tease them. I remember the first time that I saw this, I thought it was the clearest example of teasing a single-celled organism that I've ever seen before. We had some magnetotactic bacteria under the microscope. We had a little magnet. We'd stick the magnet to one side of the scope, force them all to swim like crazy toward the magnet, and then we'd flip the magnet around and then force them to all swim as fast as they could in the other direction. We could make them swim back and forth and back and forth like that by just flipping the magnet. So if you're fortunate enough to actually isolate some with a method that I just mentioned, you might actually get a chance to play with them under the microscope after that. Third group of proteobacteria that are accessible and that you might have a possibility of seeing and which have an interesting story associated with them are another alpha proteobacterial group, and they are bioluminescent. They give off light. And other organisms that you know or have heard of that give off light include fireflies, sometimes called lightning bugs. There are some fungi that grow in some woods, both temperate and tropical, that if your eyes are accustomed to the light, you can see them giving off a dim glow of light. There are dinoflagellates, which are microorganisms, single-celled, but they're not bacteria, which can be seen sometimes in the wake of a boat, both in temperate and tropical waters. Sometimes you see a beautiful display of dinoflagellates out the back of a cruise ship going through tropical waters, for example, and those are not bacteria. And there are certain fish that are bioluminescent. So I start by disclaimers. I'm telling you all the things that these are not, so that when you do see them, you know what you're seeing. Okay, so it's none of the above. So bioluminescence, you're beginning to conclude, I hope, is pretty widespread, and it is pretty widespread. But again, the question comes up, what are bacteria doing with this? You can imagine why a firefly might be blinking its lights off and on. It's signaling to a mate. There might be some reasons for certain fish to be bioluminescent, but what does a little bacterium need with giving off light? And it, is a single bacterium giving off enough light to make a difference? So let me see if I can explain this a little bit. The first thing to realize is that actually, many, many, many chemical reactions give off a certain amount of light, but usually indetectably so. Usually nothing that you would remark on, nothing that would be worth remarking on. But photons being given off by a reaction is not all that unusual, photons being the little incremental units of light. So light being given off by reactions is not unusual. So as far as having a reaction giving off light, that's not what's interesting. It's giving off a quantity of light, a rather large quantity of light, such that if you had a whole group of these bacteria together, they would actually glow. One single bacterium you wouldn't see, but a whole group of them you would see glowing faintly in the dark. And why might they be doing that? Well, here's how you might go about looking for them. Many of them are marine, and many of them are the normal digestive system bacteria of fish and other ocean animals. And when those fish die and begin to decay, the bacteria begin to participate in that decay and can cause the entire fish to glow faintly in the light. So where might you see these? You might be walking along a beach at night in a place where lights are not going to interfere with your night vision, and you might see a dead fish on the beach, and you might see a faint, faint glow from that dead fish. Or you might have a bucket of shrimp that has gone past its prime, that is on its way to being used for bait. And again, it might be a pitch dark night, because it's got to be dark for you to see this, and there might be just the faintest eerie glow in that bucket of shrimp past its prime. So those are bioluminescent bacteria that can glow in the dark from the alpha proteos. But there's more to the story, because this is a reaction that takes a fair amount of energy, and it takes a fair amount of oxygen. So why waste energy doing something like this? What could possibly be going on? One of the things that might be going on is that oxygen, for the most part, in the wrong place, is harmful to many, many chemical reactions. So it could be as simple as an oxygen detoxification mechanism. And that's one hypothesis for how this might have come about in some bacteria. It's a way to take oxygen away, just like the use of hemoglobin in a previous example, and to let that oxygen be occupied with something else rather than interfering with other reactions. But that doesn't completely explain what's going on. There are lots of other ways to detoxify oxygen. There are lots of ways to keep it away from reactions. Here's what else might be going on. That glowing fish on the beach represents a whole population of bacteria that have just lost their host. They were the digestive system bacteria for that host, and now it's dead. They would love, perhaps, to attract another host, and perhaps a glowing carcass is a good way, especially at night, to get another fish to eat at least parts of this decaying animal, and the bacteria are right back again into their next host. So one possibility is this is part of a cycle that is somewhat advantageous to the bacteria, in that they're not for long, perhaps, outside of a host, but are quickly going to be part of a cycle that gets them right back inside of the next host's digestive system. But there's even something better than that. Many, many, many organisms in the deep sea below the photic zone are bioluminescent, and we know very little about them. Some get hauled up in dredges, some get hauled up in nets, some get spotted going by fleetingly so that you can barely identify what they are when researchers are down in research submarines. So there's still an awful lot that we don't know. But for the few that have been studied, many of them are in symbioses with bioluminescent bacteria, so that they actually have a relationship with specialized organs for culturing those bacteria and for making those bacteria part of their usual signaling system and behavior that they do with those lights. And it calls to mind a question when I think about a symbiosis like this, a bioluminescent symbiosis between fish and bacteria, such that the fish have a whole set of behaviors and morphologies around this. They've got special compartments. They signal their mates with these bacteria. What is it that defines a fish? I mean, if you were to describe that fish in an ichthyology book or in a manual to fish or a field guide to fish, you would certainly describe special structures that were giving off light. That would be a major criterion. You would certainly describe particular behaviors using light to attract mates or to attract prey or to startle predators. And what if all these were bacterial? Then what's the fish? And that's sort of a rhetorical question, but you know, what's the fish? What becomes the fish in a symbiosis in which you've got such important aspects of it that are bacteria are responsible for? So there's a whole range of bioluminescent activities, all the way from simple oxygen detoxification through just attracting a place to be next in from a decayed fish to a fish that will be the next host, to a real full-blown symbiosis with elaborate behaviors and elaborate structures. And you find alpha proteobioluminescent bacteria along that entire range. So that's the third charismatic example of proteobacteria. Final example is one that I really love and one that I would love to know more about. It's an ongoing project for me and maybe an ongoing project for you if you get inspired by this. It's a group of proteobacteria from the deltas. So they're delta proteos. And they are the myxobacteria, M-Y-X-O-B-A-C-T-E-R-I-A. And these are the bacteria for you if you already enjoy lichens and tiny fungi and slime molds even in your walks in the woods. If you enjoy looking at a rotting log and looking at it very, very closely and finding that it's wonderfully full of the most exquisite tiny, tiny gardens of fungi and lichens and even slime molds. And slime molds are an entity unto themselves. They're fascinating, but if you want to look them up, they're often in fungal field guides. So they're often incorporated into a study of fungi. And if you already enjoy looking at these tiny little communities of organisms on logs, then look a little harder because there is a whole group of delta proteos, the myxobacteria, that make structures that are enormous by bacterial standards, enormous, half a millimeter to a millimeter high. Now, granted, a millimeter is not very tall, but by bacterial standards, it's a skyscraper. So think of a tiny structure, maybe a millimeter high, an exquisite little structure with a little stalk and maybe little branches and maybe in yellows and oranges and tan colors. And those are structures made by myxobacteria, which are doing something absolutely amazing. They live in the soil, and they swarm around looking for whatever detritus or debris might be in the soil that they can digest. But if food is used up, they will band together and hoist into the air these amazing little structures made of thousands of them all together, concerted effort to make these tiny structures about a millimeter high. And once they've lifted these structures up off the forest floor, up off the surface of the log, any sort of rainstorm or windstorm will blow them easily to some other location where they will again go back to a single-celled existence in the soil, but presumably in a new area with a new start and perhaps with new nutrients. So when I say this is a project for me, maybe a project for you, I love looking very, very closely at a rotting log. It's one of a favorite things for me to do. And I don't know enough about slime molds and myxobacteria, but it's a project for me to learn more about them and to try to understand their position. And it's easy enough to make the first forays into that by looking at some pictures of the kind of structures that I'm talking about and noticing the beautiful colors of them, and then bringing a hand lens along next time you're walking in the woods so that you can examine things very closely. The next lecture will be about another large group of bacteria, the gram-positives. And I will remind you in that lecture that it was Dr. Hans Christian Gram who stumbled upon them when he developed his gram stain.
This ends Lecture 7.